You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the Midside, where we love Disney so much that Elliot refuses to leave work and I move down the street from the California version. Joining me this week, as you probably ascertained from the opening quip there, will not be Elliot. We only have Daniel T. Richards. What's going on this week with you, Daniel? How are things in the nation's capital? More or less rational?
Can it be less rational than irrational?
I don't know. Can it get more irrational? Like, what is the threshold for you're irrational and you can get no more irrational?
It's an interesting question, but I think we're pushing the limits of that every day. We are leading the nation and the world in our irrationality, and no one will top us in that. Other than that, it's been rainy and hot. Everyone forgets that Washington was basically taken out of swampland that no one wanted. And that's why our nation's capital was built here. So the weather is horrible, always. But, other than that, the metro still sucks.
See, to me, talking about how irrational something can get is just like with this constant battle we have with Elliot about witnessing the farce and how I argued last week, there's always more farce to witness. To me, it always seems like there's more irrationality to witness. Like, every time I think we've hit rock bottom with irrationality, somehow something comes out and I see more of it.
Yeah, something about make something foolproof and someone will make a better fool.
Right.
That same principle applies, I think.
Right.
Once you have hit peak irrationality, you misunderestimate.
Right, and that
to
actually
use their word.
Right, exactly. And that actually happened this week with another article Elliot sent us.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, we're just gonna forgo this whole news segment, whatever. We're gonna talk. Once Elliot leaves, all structure just breaks down.
Which is ironic because he's the one who pays least attention to the structure.
But somehow he's the glue. He holds it together, man. But this article was making the rounds on Facebook this week, and I don't know why, other than because. But the article is titled The article is titled "That Awkward Moment When You Realize Heath Ledger's Joker Was the Hero."
First of all, I just want to reply to that before we actually talk about the content of it.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine this author got up the next morning and said, "That awkward moment when you realize you're actually a moron."
Yeah, well, one can only dream.
This shows how perverse some people are. We'll get into the content in a second, but this guy is either a contrarian by nature, and he's just trying to show, haha, look how smart I am, I can twist anything into the opposite, or he's one of these people who really has integrated relativism and social justice with the way he approaches this.
Yeah. There is some evidence to suggest that he is just a contrarian douchebag, and that's because his name is Jeff Rauner. Jeff with one F.
Oh yeah, and didn't he have like a whole Facebook page and everything? He used to be called Jeff with one F or something.
One F! F him.
And this is all, he was like WWE, get the F out when they changed. And then this was all to promote some book he's writing, right?
I'm sure.
Which really some makes nonsense. You want to read a book where someone like the Joker could be a hero.
Also, Houston Press, where this is published, are we a little late on the Dark Knight theorizing? That ship has sailed and almost sank.
Well, I'm assuming Houston Press is the old school print media, right?
Yeah.
So they probably
just
put this website up yesterday.
Yeah. This was published 5 days ago, by the way. So let's dive into this nonsense head first. This is how he starts his article. I've been seeing a lot of articles lately with headlines like "Why Heath Ledger's Joker Will Never Be Matched." No, you haven't. No. You created that so you could envision some imaginary news hook to make this completely non-timely article in some way timely.
I think he was just reading comments on Supernauts and Pulp Epic and Ain't It Cool News, because those are the kind of people, and any comic book news site, I think those are the kind of people that say that stuff. That was what people were... What they're talking about a little bit is he may have seen this in response to the Jared Leto Joker picture where everyone flipped out because he had self-referential tattoos, because we're not living in a hipster self-referential society where even Girl Meets World is meta now. And people flipped out about that. And then other people were replying, no, no, no. Remember when they said Heath Ledger's Joker would be awful, but it was awesome? So he's probably involved in that conversation somehow, to be generous to him.
To be generous to his incredibly small subculture.
Well, I gotta start him up high because we're gonna really tear him down.
The end of his first paragraph is, while he was mulling over the nonsense he was reading, I've come to the conclusion that the Joker is actually the hero of the film. More than that, he's arguably better at it than Batman. The premise of his argument is that Batman and the Joker are basically doing the same kinds of things. They're not, the Joker isn't destroying for destruction's sake. He's destroying bad institutions, like the bank he robs. He's robbing money from a mob bank. And the police force that he's taking out is actually a really corrupt police force. So he's doing all the things that Batman wants to do. He's just way better at it than Batman. Therefore, he's actually the hero.
Which is ridiculous because he's basically just embraced the Joker's premise of anarchy and nihilism. It's the idea that there is nothing of value worth protecting. Because the whole premise of what Batman is doing is he's going to root out the corruption so it doesn't corrupt everything, because Gotham's not completely corrupt yet. Right? It's a metaphor. Nolan's Gotham was a metaphor for America in that way. Where some people are claiming, as this guy is doing, as social justice warriors do, that America is so corrupt that it's so far gone. But the whole point of Batman in the Nolan sense was it's not so far gone. Batman is a symbol that can get rid of the corruption. But if you're literally believing everything is corrupt, well, there is no hero or villain anymore, which was the whole point of the Joker. Everything's corrupt. Let's watch the world burn.
Yeah, and one of the things about Joker's character is he is a pure nihilist, I think, in the sense that there is nothing for him that would stop him from destroying. There is no organization of society, there is no government, there is no official, there is no anything that would stop him from burning piles of money or blowing up an empty hospital just because he wants to blow it up. Or creating an actual lifeboat scenario with civilians on ferries and making them pick their own fate. He is a destroyer by his nature. That is what he wants to do.
Well, that's the irony of this writer's point is, you know, I said this it was a metaphor for America, but the character of the Joker itself is just, as you said, nihilism portrayed. So it doesn't matter what version of Batman they had in the movie, this Joker would have always been the same. But what he represents internal to this story is the greatest threat to America. And it's the idea that we have no values anymore. We just destroy our values. That's our greatest goal in America, is just destroy anything that's good. That's why Nolan put him in the movie. And by embracing that and saying that he's the hero, the writer, by saying the Joker's the hero, he's become what Nolan is trying to warn us against in the movie.
Yeah, that's very true. It's an interesting point. So, I don't know. To me, this is a sort of attention-grabbing thing. It's hard for me to believe that Jeff would think that this is serious, and that he would...
So you might say to him, why so serious?
I might, if I was you, and I liked puns. I do like puns.
That's why I like to follow Brett Dalton on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Don't know who that is.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But I think you're right. I agree with you that this is just attention grabbing. And this creates like a twofold problem. One, this destroys all content on the internet because everyone's just trying to attention grab. And two, this makes it harder for people who have legitimately good content to get attention. And what I mean by that is this guy is doing this, as I said, just to promote some book he wrote or something.
Yeah, Jeff has a new story about robot sharks. called A Senseless Killing Machine, out now in Lurking in the Deep.
So what
you can also connect with him on Facebook.
Does the Jaws ride at, like, Universal go, like, does it get AI? And, like, I don't even understand. Robot sharks? Like, I don't understand anymore.
Whatever it is, it's probably the hero.
See, that's the thing about, I mean, we're talking about, yeah, it's probably the hero. We're talking about witnessing the forest, and it always gets worse, and it always gets more irrational. I thought when I made a zombie web series, I was like, I am on the fringe of society, I'm doing something ridiculous. You know, this is the, you know, when I was growing up, that this was like, had the cult followings and everything. And now you even sent me the other day, Daniel, you sent me like, Nazis riding flying sharks or something?
Not just Nazis, my friend.
Zombies.
Yeah. Riding flying sharks. Yes. Crowdfunding now on Kickstarter.
This is due to our valueless culture, right? Because we have no values, we can't write a story with a legitimate theme, because themes come from values, and they're the reflection of abstract values, how we see them in reality. And now we just try to do the most ridiculous plot mechanic thing to get people to watch our movies, right?
Yeah, this is something that I identified when I was in high school, actually, when I asked my teacher why all new art or literature didn't have to be good anymore, it only had to be new. And his answer was legitimately, well, everything's been done already. So you just have to be new and evocative and provocative. And so I said, well, that's retarded. And then I started reading classic literature. But I'm not a poet. I don't read poetry usually for fun. But some friends of mine are getting married, and I've been asked to participate in the ceremony, and so I was looking up poetry. By the way, if anyone has any suggested poetry, you can tweet at Daniel T. Richards.
Robert Frost.
No!
Get them really depressed. We need two words
converging in the woods for a wedding. But I did the stupid thing, which I shouldn't have done, which is, in a desperation, I clicked on the contemporary poetry tab. The contemporary poetry tab that covers weddings and love is just a bunch of jumbled word nonsense. It's just a bunch of feeling light stabbing darkness in my heart. Your penis is like a bird in the night taking over the stop horror. Oh, break apart, death, dying, destruction, we shall be together, but not forever. Like, that is a poem that is supposed to be about getting married.
Wait, was that a real poem, or did you just make that up?
That was actually an original by me, but
I
took some of those lines from various different poems, so.
The dick line was from a...
Part of the thing about these poems is that they do this crazy abstraction nonsense, and then it's all of a sudden it's like, and then he thrust it inside me, and I felt it all up in me, and then light, color, fragrance. It's like, what the hell is going on here?
It sounds like all of these poems are just William Shatner on LSD.
Yeah, they're bad perfume commercials, is what they remind me of. But
is there such thing as a good perfume commercial?
If Zack Snyder directed it.
Wow.
I'd buy that perfume.
That caveat is thrown out the window whenever I ask a question like that.
Yeah. My point being, this sort of is nihilism applied to art. And this whole concept of there's nothing good, there's nothing bad, there's just either new or destruction or deconstruction. And this is the kind of thing where we get A Senseless Killing Machine, a story about robot sharks.
He must be so pissed. Can we send him the Kickstarter or whatever, the crowdfunding for the zombie Nazis on flying sharks, to see how pissed this guy gets because he got one-upped?
All it is a series of one-upmanship. Next it'll be, Nazi zombie sharks flying robot unicorns.
Right, because of course you know where the Nazi zombies came from, right?
No.
Oh, there's, I think they're Norwegian horror films, Dead Snow. Where
no.
it's literally Nazi zombies.
No.
And then
Nazi
they made fun of that
in
the, and then they made fun of that in the South Park video game, which is basically like an episode of South Park where it's open world and you can walk around. You actually fight Nazi zombies in the game.
Huh. All right, then. Well, another one of our favorite topics was in the news again this week. The Avengers. Yes, we're talking about the Avengers again, but also Man of Steel. Yes. Sonny Bunch over at the Washington Post.
Who's only one person? It's not a group of happy people.
He's the singular Sonny Bunch. Wrote an article called The Avengers versus Man of Steel, in which he gives a quick review of Avengers Age of Ultron, which actually mirrors a little bit of what we said about the book. The movie.
That would have been one shitty book.
Long as a fucking book. He points out at the beginning, for instance, when Iron Man decides it is more important to grab three people out of a collapsing tenement than focus on the world-ending event that only he can save, he wrote in his notebook, "Oh, bleep, the civilians, get on with it." And he sort of mirrors what we said about why are they showing them saving civilians? Like, this is a waste of our time and our energy as viewers.
Right, as viewers, I want to be clear. In reality, saving civilians would be awesome. But we're not watching a film to watch reality. We're watching a film to watch heightened and exaggerated and emphasized versions of these conflicts. And the conflict is not always superpowered person has to save weak person.
Yeah. I would like superpowered person to overcome a superpowered villain or problem.
You mean like General Zod?
Yes. Yes, in which he takes it, and so in this article, Sonny Bunch, the singular guy, takes to task the people who thought that the Man of Steel destruction was useless and the killing of Zod was awful or grotesque. Let's see, what's a good line here? He says, "I've never found the line of argument that Superman in Man of Steel doesn't care enough about civilians particularly compelling. In part, that's because making this case involves ignoring the first half of the film. We repeatedly see Clark Kent using his powers to save people, putting himself and his family at risk. He continues to aid people even after his father gives his own life to keep Clark's alien identity secret. Further, this argument suggests that Superman is responsible for all the destruction of Metropolis, a notion that I find hard to fathom, because Zod creates the world engine, which destroys most of the city, and at the point in which they fight, most of the city is evacuated." So what do you think about his argument in general that, because there's a bit of a twist in the conclusion here, right? So he takes Avengers to task, he sort of defends Superman, but basically says at the end that Superman is a more realistic portrayal of war. And Age of Ultron is a more 90s sort of smart bomb, precision targeting, protect the innocent civilian version of war. Did you see that coming? I was kind of thrown off.
Honestly, that pissed me off when I read it. And you wonder why it pissed me off?
Because his name is Sonny Bunch?
No. Oh. Because it came across more as someone trying to sound smart than being smart. Now, this seems like he's trying to say that realism is the base value in storytelling, therefore Man of Steel is better because it's more realistic for modern society, and then he props up a false dichotomy as having Avengers represent the 90s or something for some reason. But this goes back to a discussion we've had with Elliot where he wants us to create a stylistic compass where we have romanticism, naturalism, and then like realism and fantasy as our four points. But that's one of the problems I have with this whole thing is, are either of these realism? Can we argue that Man of Steel is realism at all? And why are we saying realism's a value necessarily in storytelling? It just, it comes out of nowhere because it's like he's smuggling in like eight things. And it confuses me.
Yeah, the premise is very, the conclusion is very confused in this article. I agree with a lot of his assessments, I just don't understand how he gets to the end. To answer your question about realism, I mean, I think realism can be fine in telling a story, especially if you want to tell a morality tale. But it doesn't have to be realism in the documentary sense of realism. And again, the compass thing, I think there's something to that. I'll defend Elliot, and I'm still trying to figure that out. But one of the problems with it is that you can diagnose a movie in its entirety, where you can diagnose a scene, right? And so I think Avengers overall isn't naturalistic, But the portrayal at the end about what the heroes would do, meaning save the civilians and not really focus on the greater problem, that was a naturalistic choice in an overall non-naturalistic film.
Right, but that goes back to underlying ideas, and that's what I think he's trying to get at, is he's saying the ideas in Man of Steel are more realistic.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Which, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, that's why Man of Steel resonates with me more. I think it's more reflective of what would happen if a powered person really came to exist in the world. I think that that is an accurate portrayal of how it would happen, especially from the point of view of the powered person.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly fine to do in telling a story that has morals applicable to human beings.
Right, because the point I'm getting at is I don't think realism is used in the way we even just used it, and that's why I get confused with what they're saying, because I don't know how they're using it. I think realism is oftenly swapped out for the word naturalism, where they're trying to portray the world as it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Absolutely. I don't think realism means naturalism.
Yeah, but this guy, in general, again, I can't tell. Is he just a contrarian or not?
Don't know. Looked at his Facebook. Looks like John Hodgman.
Which
he's like the conservative John Hodgman.
He's a contrarian, right? Because John Hodgman was a contrarian to Apple in that Apple commercial.
Yeah. And he's also the host of a podcast, which I recently learned to enjoy, thanks to a friend of mine in Chicago named Hannah, called the Judge John Hodgman Podcast, where I think you'll actually like the premise, even if you don't like the execution. He basically takes on the role of judge in cases of almost kind of trivial arguments between people, like whether or not a fiancé should continue sleeping with her teddy bear from middle school after they've been married. Like, he hears both sides and then makes a ruling. I don't know. Maybe you'll think that's annoying.
I mean, are these 14-year-olds getting married pre-industrial revolution?
No. Or the other one that was argued the other day was whether or not a guy should basically stop... how would they phrase it? So the guy is a whiskey snob, but he'll drink any sort of beer. And his friend wants him to upgrade from PBR to better tasting beer. And the argument was whether or not he should do that.
That's
okay.
Like,
I know I've lost you because we've talked about alcohol.
Yeah, I was like, I can think of who would be a perfect audience for that episode, but it's not me. I can tell you an exact person. He may have been on the show in the Lost season, and that's not a reference to the show Lost. It's our Lost season.
Yes, perhaps.
Anyway. When I'm talking about this guy being a contrarian, you pointed out when we were doing our pre-show prep here, when we realized Elliot wouldn't be here, we were kind of figuring out what we were going to cut, what we were going to keep, and you pointed out that this guy had a theory about the Mad Men finale, the series finale, where he said the whole thing is just trolling Don Draper.
Yes.
And I said, hold on, I got to read this, because, you know, by the time everyone hears this, it'll be a few days after the Mad Men finale, but it's been a day since I saw it, because it aired last night. It aired Sunday night. Mad Men's done for good. It, you know, it did exactly what it did the whole time. It moved along slow and ploddingly, and then at the end it kind of had a moment, and that was it. So, Daniel, you probably are glad you didn't watch it, because anyone expecting big fireworks at the end, just kind of like, it ended with Don Draper meditating. So...
God, I'm so glad I didn't watch this show.
So I've been just digesting as much as I can, consuming and digesting as much as I can to sort of see what people are thinking about this. But I will say that I think there are two reasons, Daniel, you should be sad about having not watched this show.
Oh, okay.
So the first is, it is brilliantly integrated. If you look at the beginning of the show and the end of the show, you see how everything was set up in the beginning and how it pays off in the end. And you can see that he had a clear plan that he actually executed. And I have seen that rarely in very few shows, if the only one I've ever seen might be Breaking Bad, the only other one like that. Where you can see from the end, you knew it was always Breaking Bad, it was always going to be the story of Walt dying. It was just going to be ironic the way he brought about his death, even though it was supposed to be the cancer that killed him. It was the metaphoric cancer of evil that killed him. That was always the setup there, right?
All right. I like integration.
Right.
I'm on board so far.
So... that's the first, is It's brilliantly integrated. You see they set up, you know, McCann Erickson, where Don Draper ends up working, and they set that up early. They set up the whole Coca-Cola payoff very early on, where they tease, they say Betty can be the Coca-Cola girl. All this stuff is set up. You see that this is the journey Don is going on. And now, I think you also have to appreciate Mad Men from a thematic standpoint. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to briefly tell you what happens. Then I'm going to read quotes from episode one, and I'm going to read the key quote from the last episode, from the series finale, and I want you to see if you can figure out what this show is all about, because I think this speaks to the skill of the writing. So,
okay, is it about smoking and whiskey?
No, that's a metaphor.
First guess. Okay.
The first clue I'm going to give you is the first episode is called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and that is a metaphor. Yeah. It starts out about smoking, but that's a metaphor for things literally obscuring your vision.
So that was kind of right, though.
Well, you're right from a metaphoric sense, yes.
I'll take it.
But I know you were playing with concretes with your joke there, so I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
So what basically happens over the back half of season 7 here, even though they split into two seasons, it's really season 8, is... the agency Don works at gets bought out by McCann Erickson. All the partners in it try to scramble and figure out what to do. Peggy, who's a big character, who's a rising star, tries to figure out what to do because it kind of has her career off track. So she doesn't know what to do because she's been focused on her career the whole time. And, you know, to have it kind of taken away from her when she's disregarded her personal life for it. Don tries to figure out what to do. And ultimately what Don does is he does what he always does. He goes and he runs. He just leaves his job and he's like, I'm just going to go across the country and figure out what's going to happen. And he ends up at, now this is the most disappointing thing about the finale, because a professor that we both had at Clemson started watching the show and he told me that I was going to end up with Dawn and Bell Bottoms, you know, because of the whole hippie movement in the 70s. And I was like, no, they won't do that to Dawn. Now, Dawn did not end up changing the way he was dressed. But as I did say, he ended up meditating, and it was during yoga, and it was on a hippie commune.
Oh, no.
So it's kind of like, did they undermine it that way? But I don't think they did, because they kept him being Don. And what happens when he's at the hippie commune is he basically is in a group therapy session where people are saying why they're there. And while he's there, this one guy who's dressed similar to him gives this whole speech about loneliness and not being noticed, and that's why he's there. Because he just feels invisible, basically. And then, while he's giving the speech, and that's the quote I'm gonna read in a second here, while he's giving this speech, I go to myself, Don's gonna get up and hug him. Because this show is so well integrated that anyone who's intelligent and understands writing understands that the only possible reaction Don Draper can have to that is hugging him. And Don Draper gets up and hugs him. And that's good writing, where you know it's coming, but you also say, I want it to happen. Then, you know, we have a montage of all the different characters. They've all had certain realizations. And because of that, they all have received they've all reached a modicum of acceptance and happiness. So, you know, Joan's starting her own business. Peggy realizes she's in love with the guy she's been working closely with the whole time. Pete, actually, the second-hander, realizes he's been second-handed and gets a really awesome job and gets his family back together. Roger falls legitimately in love. So all of these characters sort of have this montage, and in this montage they have their moments. Then it cuts to the final scene, which is Don Draper meditating in a yoga class. And he says, Om, you know, like in yoga, Om. He smiles, and after he smiles, it cuts to the famous Coca-Cola commercial of That's the Real Thing. Do you know that commercial?
No. I don't know if I'm familiar with that one or not. So, I mean, not from that title, certainly.
Well, it's the really hippie one where it's I Wanna Buy the World a Coke. And it's all hippies,
yep.
And then it goes, That's the Real Thing in the chorus.
Yep, gotcha.
So then the show cuts out.
So are they saying that that's the ad that Don created?
Okay. That's one of the major mechanical things about this. That's the debate here. Is did Don's realization cause him to create the advertisement? My argument is yes. Because one, it creates the whole Dawn is an advertising genius storyline to keep going. And over the second half of the season, and even in the final episode, Peggy was like, if you come back, they'll take you back. They always do. Don't you want to work on Coca-Cola? And that's why I'm saying it was set up from the beginning. And this is a real ad, and it's considered one of the greatest ads of all time. And the chorus, as I said, has the line, that's the real thing, in it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things Dawn always tried to do, whenever he was pitching something or coming up with creative for an advertisement, he was trying to find out the reality, the truth in it that would resonate with people. With me?
Yep.
Now it's time for the quotes. The quotes from episode one are about his philosophy of advertising. Now the quote from the finale is that guy's speech about how he felt.
Okay.
So episode one. Advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And do you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of a road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing is okay. You are okay. Second quote. The reason you haven't felt it is because it doesn't exist. What you call love was invented by guys like me to sell nylons. You're born alone and you die alone. And this world just drops a bunch of rules on top of you to make you forget these facts. But I never forget. I'm living like there's no tomorrow, because there isn't one. Now, when you consider these two quotes together, what kind of a view does it give you of Don Draper?
He's a very, he has a negative sense of life.
Very, very lonely man looking for external reassurance.
Yeah.
Right.
He shows someone who has deep anxiety about living, maybe self-esteem issues in some regard.
Correct. Which is jives with his character where he's not really Don Draper. He took the name of somebody called Don Draper at war to get out of war, and he's actually Dick Whitman. So there's this whole thing, the whole series, about him trying to make everyone okay with him by lying to them about who he really is. Now, do you see where that's the real thing is starting to come in?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, so now this is the speech the guy gives in the finale, in the therapy session. I watch my wife and my kids. They don't look up when I sit down. It's like no one cares that I'm gone. They should love me. Maybe they do, but I don't even know what it is. You spend your whole life thinking you're not getting it. People aren't giving it to you. Then you realize they're trying, and you don't even know what it is. I had a dream I was on a shelf in the refrigerator. Someone closes the door and the light goes off. And I know everybody's out there eating. And then they open the door and you see them smiling. And they're happy to see you, but maybe they don't look right at you. And maybe they don't pick you. Then the door closes again. The light goes off. And at that point, Dawn gets up and goes over and hugs him.
It's a very interesting kind of writing style.
Well, it reads like an advertising pitch, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, I was going to say it's written like a series of ads.
Right. And always the pitches Dawn gave mirrored what was going on in his life. Doesn't that sound like the dream that he's a Coca-Cola? He's a soda in the fridge and someone's coming to get him?
Yeah.
So giving the world a Coke is like telling them it's going to be okay. Because what did this guy ultimately want to be told? That it was okay.
Yeah.
Because he felt like he wasn't being loved. And that goes back to what Dawn was saying in the beginning is, this idea of love we have in our head, which is external, because what's this guy looking for? He's looking for someone to come into the refrigerator to look at him and make him feel like he's loved. Where, how does he have to be loved? He has to do what Don did in the end, where he finally said to Peggy, I'm not the man you think I am. I took someone else's name. I scandalized my kids. I didn't do a good thing with the name. I didn't make something of that name. So he finally owned who he actually was. And that's what gave him the peace in the final shot, which was able to say, well, how he created the Coca-Cola advertisement of, that's the real thing. I just want to give the world a Coke. Because what he wants to give them is his understanding of happiness. Be real, be yourself, and it comes from yourself.
Huh. I think I'm much more satisfied with your explanation of the show than I would be the show itself.
It takes a lot of patience to watch it. Is that why you're saying that?
Yeah, partially because, you know, 24, for instance, was shot in real time. I think Mad Men is shot in half real time.
Well, it's very, because it's about slice of life, and it's because it's about, you know, and this goes back to what we were saying earlier about the realism stuff, because it's about how you're looking for reassurance every day, and really it's about the search for happiness. These people are all mad in the sense that they're crazy because they're looking for happiness else outside of themselves. Right? There was the whole there was actually a whole season, I think it was 4, that started out Who is Don Draper, where it was all about you can do what you want or you can try to please other people. And I'm sorry, there's no way somebody has that dichotomy and they've never read Ayn Rand or, you know, seen that season of House where House deals with the same issues.
Well, it's called Who is Don Draper, and isn't Ayn Rand, like, mentioned in the first episode or
something? Well, in the early season, yeah, in the first season they say, Ayn Rand would really love you. You're like an Ayn Rand hero, basically. But you could make the argument that the whole show is undermining it, because the last episode is called Person to Person. So you could make the argument that it's like Lost, where it's saying that all that matters ultimately is what other people think of you. But I don't think that speech reflects that.
Damn you, Dharma. Dharma ruins everything.
I don't think the speech reflects that, though. I think the speech shows what's making this man so unhappy is that he's waiting for them to acknowledge him. He's expecting something that doesn't really exist, this false version of love.
Yeah. It's interesting. So then Don gives it to him.
Yeah, I guess that's what he's doing, right? When he hugs him, is he showing him that, you know, I understand you. But yeah. I think the hug was as much for himself, because that was what he needed to hear the whole series.
Yeah.
He needed to see. Because part of when you go through something like that, and I think this is the part of the show that didn't really get revealed, and it's something, you know, we've talked about before in our personal lives, and I think we don't tell enough of these stories in our society because of naturalism and egalitarianism. We're trying to tear everyone down and make everyone the same. But when you're really good at something, or you're more educated, or you're smarter, it can carry with it a loneliness if you don't find peers, because you experience the world in a fundamentally different way. And for someone like Don Draper, he would have been experiencing the world in a fundamentally different way, because he's demonstrably smarter than everyone else, right, in his way. I'm not saying he's smarter across the board, but I'm saying he's clearly a creative genius. And clearly he was being he's shown throughout the whole series coming up with some of the greatest advertisements ever.
Yeah.
So he would fundamentally be lonely. So what he really needed to hear was he had a peer who felt that way too. Because even the people who were working with him weren't able to be that real to admit that. You know, I'm sure the people around him were peers like Roger and Pete, but they were all too afraid to admit that because they didn't want to be rejected for who they really were. But this guy on the hippie retreat was able to do that. So that's why I don't really take the hippie thing as saying, you know, hippieism is what saved Don Draper. But the show always sort of had Don Draper represent America. And I do think when we look at post-Vietnam, a lot of the angst of hippieism was us trying to figure out who we were in the world and what our identity was now and what the real America was.
Yeah. Interesting point. Well, I don't think you've convinced me that I'm going to watch it, but I think you've convinced me that it has more value than I previously thought it did.
It's one of the best shows ever.
That's interesting.
Hands down, it has to be. I mean, just from even if it's not like the most enjoyable to watch, like there were some episodes that were phenomenal. Like The Suitcase is one of the best episodes of television ever. I said that a few podcast episodes ago. But it may not have always been the most enjoyable to watch, but from a pure craft standpoint, you have to admire it.
From a Bob Craft standpoint?
Let's hold off on that.
Oh.
We have a Reddit question before that. That's our second Reddit, right? Let's do this first Reddit first.
Teaser.
Yeah, because people really want to hear more Spygate stuff. Although we did get positive reviews, or one positive review from that episode, right?
Yes. I don't know. Did we?
Yeah, it was Mark. I really appreciated his comment where he said, "I still don't know what a Tom Brady is, but I really like an angry Justin."
Oh.
I really like Angry Justin. Yes. I thought that was a really funny way of saying it, so.
Yes.
Speaking of funny, Reddit asks us, what's the funniest event in history?
They have some good ones in here, including the Australian Emu War and the famous Julius Caesar takedown on the Senate floor where they were debating, and a page delivers a private message to Julius Caesar, and the guy
via
who's
Facebook
debating...
or Twitter?
Via papyrus. Not the font. And the guy who was debating Cato was demanding that the letter be read to the whole Senate, and Caesar was like, no, it's a private letter, and then Cato insisted, and so finally Julius Caesar relented, and it was actually a love letter from Cato's half-sister to Julius Caesar.
See, that sounds just like social media, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Things have not really changed.
Yeah. But the one thing I learned being from Texas, actually, is that Mexican General Santa Anna, after the Texas Revolution, Santa Anna actually lost his leg and had to be amputated. But Santa Anna was such a supreme narcissist that he actually staged an elaborate state funeral for his amputated leg, with the whole parade and mourning, and like people had to cry, otherwise they'd be whipped, to bury his leg, his very precious leg. I always found that supremely funny.
Well, that makes California make a lot more sense.
Santa Ana.
I always found the potato famine to be funny. Is there a more Irish thing to run out of than potatoes?
What are you doing? Don't they just fly out your eyes or something? Just think of it. Potato Ray.
Yeah, no potato guns in Ireland, but I don't know, I just always found it funny because it's like, of all the things to run out of, it's potatoes.
It's true. But they always have babies.
I don't know, this was a really tough question for me. I mean, I thought it was an amusing question, but I thought all the things people picked were obscure. I thought people would pick, like, less obscure things, like the Boston Tea Party. Like, isn't it kind of ridiculous that people dressed up like Indians to throw stuff in the water to protest the government? Like, can you imagine that happening nowadays?
Can we throw Tom Brady in the Boston Harbor?
Is that more or less funny than the Ice Bucket Challenge?
Oh. Yeah, people will look back on that 100 years from now. In order to cure a disease, people dumped ice water on their heads.
Will they look back? I always wonder which of these viral things are going to be looked back on as demonstrable, representative of our culture.
Yeah, probably that and Two Girls, One Cup, I think, are really what's going to make it in history.
So we're done. There's no need to continue this podcast then.
Somewhere, somehow, one guy is going to find the recordings of our podcast, and he's going to start a revolution.
It's like Bill and Ted. Wild stallions rule.
Exactly.
But no, you know what the real funniest event in history is?
What?
Deflategate.
How did I know we were going there?
Well, we have to talk about it, especially today. But this is actually relevant to Reddit on Reddit. So I found the Patriots subreddit on Reddit. Now, I'm not going to be culling a lot of content from there. The only reason I found it was I randomly found this video that I'm really surprised hasn't been more of a news story. And then I traced it back to Reddit, and then they traced it back to, like, Barstool Sports or something. I don't know. But these two guys were driving, and they see Julian Edelman driving by in his nice car. Julian Edelman, wide receiver for the Patriots, had the winning touchdown catch in the Super Bowl. Yes, we're all familiar with Julian Edelman. If not, go look it up. Elliot, there's more people that catch footballs than Gronkowski. So they ask him, and they yell at him, and they say, what do you think of Tom Brady's suspension? And as he's driving by on the highway, he yells, it's fucking bullshit. And that's the entire video, with people laughing.
Tremendous.
Now, first of all, I'm surprised this hasn't gone more viral. But second of all, this is the thing that really is sort of still bothering me about this whole thing. I'm a lot calmer now. I've sort of made my peace with it. I'm writing a blog post. It'll be out soon. It's sort of like my report on the Wells report type deal and everything that's been happening, which it's going to have a lesson on it. I think I'm positive about the quality of how high the quality is going to be of it. But here's the thing that Julian Edelman's response represents. Has there ever been two sides in an NFL issue like this, or in a sports issue like this, that are so dug in. Because we saw earlier Monday, Bob Kraft again came out, and he did an interview with Sports Illustrated where he said exactly what I said. There was a minor controversy on my Facebook where I said, don't you think if Tom Brady did this, they would have had closed-door conversations, Kraft and Belichick and his dad and his agent, and they would have said, okay, you did this, let's move on. But clearly they've had these conversations, and the reason they're fighting so hard is he told them he's innocent. And Bob Kraft said exactly that. He said, we've had discussions, and I said, look, Tom, if you did it, let's just admit you did it and move on. And Tom Brady, or as he calls him, Tommy, told him that, you know, he didn't do it. And that, you know, Kraft said he believes him because he's known him for half his life, and he's never lied to him, and he has no evidence he's lied to him. But that's the problem I have with this story and with the Wells report. You've got one side saying it's obvious the Patriots did it. And anyone who wants to see the Patriots suspended or wants to believe the Wells report says that if you don't see that the text messages implicate Tom Brady, and you don't see that the data implicates Tom Brady, and you don't see that the Patriots are lying, there's something wrong with you. And they say that the Patriots have made this worse by just lying and not admitting they did it. They got caught. They were cheating. They got caught cheating. They should just admit it, accept it, and move on, and everyone would be okay with it. But then you have the other side saying, no, we didn't do it. There's no evidence. And these two sides are completely opposite of each other. They're diametric poles, and there is literally no middle ground here. So how do you solve this issue without either just telling the Patriots they're complete liars or fools, or telling the NFL that they completely were immoral with the way they approached this? There seems to be no middle option here.
I know how you do it. You get an independent arbiter named Roger Goodell.
Right, and isn't he just going to take the side of the NFL?
No, I mean, that's the funny thing, right, that sort of also happened since last week is Tom Brady appealed his suspension and the NFL Players Association asked for an independent arbiter, and the independent arbiter that Roger Goodell chose was Roger Goodell.
Right.
The NFL commissioner.
But don't you think he did that because he knows that there's no middle ground here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I assume he thinks he's going to piss off some people, and I think in his mind, since he's a wild and horrifyingly terrible pragmatist.
And populist.
And populist. I think those two go together quite horrifically.
Yes.
That it's probably in the end going to be better just to piss off all the Patriots fans than piss off the fans of 31 other teams.
Right. But the one sort of fly in the ointment there that may help the Patriots in the long run is people are talking about how Kraft helped Goodell raise to power. So maybe he does that and then he loses his job because of it. I don't know.
Yeah. It just
really bothers me that there are people out there, and this is, you know, I'm not just talking about internet commenters. This is like people on ESPN. I was at the gym earlier and I saw Mark Brunell saying this, former NFL quarterback, saying that it's obvious that the Patriots did this. He was in the league for 20 years, and he knows that equipment managers and ball boys help the quarterbacks get the balls to where they want. That the number one priority of equipment managers and ball boys is to make sure the quarterback's equipment is exactly how he wants it. So it's obvious to him that the Patriots did this. And, you know, you have these people on ESPN, on all of these websites writing, where they say, based upon the text messages, it's obvious that the Patriots are lying and that Brady's covering up and this is all a cover-up. And it bothers me because, to me, I'm on the diametric opposite pole where it's not obvious. And I just, this is why I'm writing the blog post. I don't want to give away the ending of the blog post, but there's only one logical conclusion I've come to, and I haven't integrated it emotionally yet. And I don't know if you have integrated it emotionally yet, Daniel. But because I haven't integrated it yet emotionally, it makes it difficult for me to comprehend all of this. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I got you. What I've done with it is essentially compartmentalize it for the time being, which is sort of like, this is a thing that is in flux. Let me deal with it when it's less in flux. I sort of came out strong with you against the nonsensical Wells report. I think we've circled the wagons, and now we just have to wait for the engines to attack.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, are you just ignoring the people who are saying these things on the opposite poll?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Completely and utterly. I think that happened before. I think that happened before I was born. I just decided to ignore most all human beings.
Because you've integrated the thing that I haven't yet integrated. Is that the point?
Yeah, maybe. I don't want to attack you here or raise myself up unnecessarily. I just think I am, in general, way more nonchalant about these kind of things.
Well, like, and I think it's because, I mean, look, this is the mid-side. Nothing's sacred, right? Everything's explainable.
Kill the sacred cows.
I am not above reproach, even though I am the host of the mid-side. I am not above reproach.
I'm going to get that drop.
And, no, I think it's fair to say that you're nonchalant about it. And that's what I'm wondering, is the reason you're nonchalant is because that stuff like this, you've already explained this ahead of time. Whereas with me, this seems like unbelievable. Do you get the difference?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I haven't thought about it so much, but.
Well, you will when you read my blog post on it.
I can't wait. Where would we find that blog post when it comes up?
When it comes up, which should be in the next couple of days if I can find any time to actually do anything, it will be on themidside.com.
All right. You know what else you can find on themidside.com?
This podcast.
Our past podcast episodes. That's right. You can also find other writings of Justin and things about the zombie web series and many other bits of information that you might find interesting. You can also tweet at the Midside or find us on Facebook.
All right.
Midside.
Since we flopped things a little bit here, do you want to do what you learned since you've already shilled?
Yeah, you know what I learned? Mad Men. Not entirely worthless.
I'm glad it took the series ending for me to convince you of that. I've been telling you this the whole time.
I mean, not going to watch it, but now I don't have to actively hate it.
Yeah, we have to pick and choose what we're going to watch. And I watched it because Don Draper is the kind of character I love, and it's the kind of story I love. That whole feeling of invisibility, the whole trying to find out what's real, what's authentic, and trying to write from that and being creative from that, that's right up my alley for myself psychologically. Whereas you'll watch a House of Cards, and for me, I can't stand watching House of Cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to pick and choose what we're going to watch.
Makes sense to me. I'm not going to watch that, but power to all people who did. And I really like all the people in my news feed giving their wildly inaccurate opinions about the ending. But, you know, I come to you for the authority.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I would like to believe in the authority. And that's not just for me. Our friend Amanda from Clemson also, I've been talking to her about Mad Men since, you know, Clemson when we were watching it with each other. And she came to similar conclusions and we really sort of hashed that out today. So I wanted to make sure I talked to her about it first before I got on the podcast and said things that were completely wrong. Cause she enlightened me to, one of the things she pointed out is, I pointed out that quote that said advertising is you are okay. And, you know, pointed out how the whole series is Don wanting to know he's okay. But then she pointed out Roger Sterling, you know what he says over and over again, especially to Don, is he constantly says, it's going to be okay, Don. It's going to work out. It's going to be okay. That is intentional on the writer's part.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting.
All right, so you want to know what I learned?
What did you learn?
I learned there's an explanation for the city of Santa Ana in Orange County being as batshit crazy as it is. And it's because it was named after a batshit crazy general.
Yes. Yes, it was. Absolument. So, if you learned something this week, why don't you tell us on iTunes with a 5-star review. 5, not 4, not 3, not 1 or 2, but 5. It's 3 plus 2, 5-star review. Thanks so much, everyone who has given us so much encouragement to keep going. You guys, when we share this stuff on Facebook, you're telling us that you like it, and you laughed, and you were inspired. I'm getting choked up. So, that's how we keep going, is you like it, and you tell a friend, and then they tell a friend, and that friend tells the president, and then the NSA cracks down on us. But until then, that's how we keep going.
Then do we get a movie made after us, like Edward Snowden?
Citizen 5 and 6 and 7. Yeah.
We're up to 10 reviews. Were we 10 reviews before?
Oh, well, maybe we had only 9. I'm going to have to look. haven't been checking that lately. So thanks so much. You guys are awesome. Talk to you soon.
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a gay day! Damn it. Yeah.